Right now, let's talk about, it's often the political panel here. Right now, it's just going to be myself and Colin McDonald. He is a strategist and a consultant at Navigator, one of the great public affairs firms down in Toronto, and formerly worked at Queen's Park with various cabinet ministers. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Thank you for having me.
Want to play this clip from the former Toronto City Councillor, now Liberal MP for Toronto, Adam Vaughan, reacting to Doug Ford's big announcement on Friday.
And that is not good for the economy of Ontario, let alone Canada. That's not good for the people of Toronto, at the end of the day, who are Canadian. And I can assure you, as a federal member elected from the city, and as the Parliamentary Secretary for Urban Affairs, we've been working very hard to make sure big city mayors are at the table with the federal government as we make major decisions around infrastructure, in particular housing. We will not abandon cities, and we will not abandon Toronto.
A lot of hyperbole around this this decision. I'm not sure how changing the number of councillors affects the economy of the city, Colin, but obviously this has emotions running high. You're in Toronto. Is this really resonating outside of people like us who are obsessed with politics?
Well, I think the timing of it has a lot of people surprised. I think this is one of these things where if Premier Ford had done this in a bit more of a properly rolled out manner, people would have agreed that 47 councillors is probably too many for a city like Toronto, or for any city, quite frankly. But it's the timing of it all. It's the fact that he did it 6 hours before registration for this election was set to close, that he did it seemingly with no prior consultation with any in any substantive manner, either with citizens or with the mayor or with the current council. It's just fortunately for him, people don't typically get too angry about process, but the process of it is just a bit of a mess.
See, that's where you come in as someone that's been around this game before. You're right. People don't get angry about process, and journalists, for some reason, love to write about process. And those are the stories that go nowhere because people go, oh, okay, but politicians are being politicians. And whether it's a process story about what a Liberal government, a Conservative, or an NDP government's doing, those get lost. I think you're right about the timing. It shocked me. It wouldn't have shocked me if he had said, I want this to happen next time. But 6 hours before, that is shocking.
Yeah, and it had been sort of rumored, but it was widely seen as being something that if they hadn't done it by, well, I guess by yesterday, that they just weren't going to get around to doing it. So the fact that he came out and did it in the way that he did, and then I think you add this regional chair thing to it, and that's the one that's really surprising, right? Because that one does seem just straight up vindictive, and that's the piece I think that is going to get more news as we progress through this, because there's really very little there's very little rationale for actually doing this.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure what we got rid of regional government here, just as you did in Toronto years ago. We used to have the city of Ottawa, city of Nepean, Kanata, and then we had regional government. I thought that at the time of amalgamation, I got rid of regional governments, but I guess that was just for the areas that were amalgamated, Hamilton, Toronto, Ottawa. I'm not sure if Kitchener-Waterloo was. I can't remember at this point, but I was surprised that those were still there. One was vengeance, and that's Patrick Brown. That's clear. But the other part that isn't getting anyone talking about is getting rid of the regional chair of York, which was going to be Steve Del Duca, former Liberal cabinet minister in the Wynne government. And that was payback to Liuna, who wanted him gone because he changed the labor laws.
Well, so, I mean, this is the thing, is that you can make an argument that Doug Ford was a city councillor in Toronto. His brother, as mayor, had talked about the need to reduce city council. The size of the city council, there were probably a number of people who would jump on board and say that's a thing. But this sort of random attack on the regional chair positions, and the thing that I think is going to be lost on some people in the initial stages, and then they will actually come back to it and say, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense, is he hasn't taken away those positions. He's reverted to them continuing to be appointed. And for a premier who's supposed to be for the people, to take away their ability to vote whether you like the position of regional chair or not, whether you think that the position of regional chair is a position that should exist or not, you would probably agree that if you're going to have one and you're going to pay them a good amount of money to chair these meetings and to oversee, you know, regional services at a broad level, then why not have them elected? It's just a very strange and obviously vindictive move.
My understanding, though, is that there are a bunch of municipal vote is lower than provincial vote, lower than federal vote. My understanding is that in Mississauga, the biggest part of Peel Region, there are a pile of councillors just acclaimed. So they don't even have people running against them.
Well, I think
it doesn't show an awful lot of interest in municipal politics. That's where the regional chair position comes from, and that where the regional council comes from. And if they're not going to be even challenged, that's something.
Well, and I think that a lot of the cities around Toronto sort of suffer a little bit from interest in their local politics because so many of the people who live there come in and out of Toronto every day for work, and they actually have more exposure probably from the news and from their day-to-day conversations and everything else.
Maybe watching CP24 like we've got on in the newsroom here?
Maybe watching CP24, exactly, yeah. So I think that's a challenge for those cities. Municipally, turnout is quite low across the province, and that's a challenge for all of us. But I think it's hard to argue that we should have a system. Not a lot of people stay up at night thinking about regional chairs. But I think it's hard to argue that we should have a system where there are some regional chairs who are elected, some regional chairs who are appointed, and the move to make it all has somehow been scrapped at the last minute. It's hard to make a good case for that.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where people, as you say, don't think about it, and maybe they will come November, but they don't spend. Even though local government is the one that touches us the most, people don't spend enough time thinking about it. Speaking with Colin McDonald, he is a strategist, a consultant with Navigator Limited down in Toronto, and someone that has spent a lot of time working at Queen's Park. Colin, this is both federal and Toronto related. It comes out of the Danforth shooting, that horrific event happening a week ago today in one of the most beautiful parts of Toronto. I mean, hearing that it was happened on the Danforth when I woke up last Monday morning actually shocked me. I used to spend a lot of time there when I lived in Toronto. It's a normally peaceful, tranquil place. If you told me shooting happened somewhere else in Toronto, I'd say, yeah, okay, that's normal, or it happens too frequently. But the Danforth was a shocker. But coming out of that, we've now got the report after report saying the federal government's going to look at doing a handgun ban. Toronto City Council has called for it. I simply don't see, how banning handguns is going to actually change what happened or would have happened. We're talking about somebody that used a stolen gun, and most of the shootings that happen in Canada happen with stolen guns, most of them smuggled in from the U.S.
Yeah, I think so. I should say, I will say that this is actually my neighborhood. I live on the Danforth, or just north of the Danforth, and that was an event that was, really shocking. You mentioned
you know this cafe then?
Oh yeah, no, for sure. It's we could walk out of my house right now and be there in 5 minutes. It's very much our neighborhood, and it was really a shocking thing, and something that I guess if you're looking for good news out of things, it has been remarkable over the last number of days, the sort of the resiliency of the neighborhood, local businesses, people really coming together around it. But it's been a very difficult time around our
beautiful little 10-year-old girl and an 18-year-old woman who was supposed to be starting nursing at McMaster this past week, dying in that horrific attack. Just awful.
That's right. And I think the sort of suddenness of it and the way that it happened, and these people were just out enjoying themselves, having a bite to eat, taking in a nice summer night in a way that a lot of us, as I said, who live in the neighborhood would do on any given night. So it was shocking, and I think people are searching for answers. And I think that when you propose things, or when you talk about the proposed handgun ban, for example, sure, it might not be the be all and end all, and it might not be the piece that solves the problem. But I think people are looking for whatever they can do, whatever's within their authority to do, to start trying to feel as though they're taking some action or responsibility.
And I understand that. I mean, it's got to feel helpless. It's happening just off of where you live. I remember the shooting on Parliament Hill happening steps from my office, and the feeling around that, you do look for answers. You do look for something.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I think there are a number of this man had issues, and there should have been, his family obviously had concerns. There should have been help available to him in a way that, or at least some sort of,
There were warning signs.
There were warning signs. That's the thing. There were lots and lots of warning signs, and it never should have been allowed to get to the place that it got to. But I think that after it did, and after, dealing with or that initial sort of shock, people are looking for things that they can do to try and be active and push back against it a little bit.
Before I ask you about another topic related to NAFTA, have you been back out on the Danforth since the shooting?
We have. It's a bit unavoidable for us. Not that we want to avoid it, but it's a bit unavoidable for us. But also, we went out on, and certainly not alone in this, but we went out on Friday night with the kids, and we had dinner, and just wanted to be back out there and enjoy it. And thankfully, we were not alone in this. It almost seemed strange how almost back to normal it was. So a lot of people out enjoying themselves. Taking back that part of the street, that part of the city.
Well, it's a beautiful part of Toronto, and I'll be, making sure to drop by next time I'm there. As I said, spent a lot of time when I on the Danforth when I did live there. Colin, I want to ask you about NAFTA. We had meetings over the past few days, or last week. The Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, had a meeting with, everyone calls him AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. I think we should all just say AMLO. It's just shorter. He's the incoming president of Mexico. And she said that she's hopeful that the new populist president will be an ally for Canada heading into the NAFTA, or as the NAFTA talks continue.
We have a clear understanding now. And we certainly are very committed to moving forward as quickly as we can.
I wonder if we can actually consider him an ally, since one of his first phone calls after the election was with Donald Trump, and they apparently talked about a bilateral trade deal. And I thought, hey, wait a minute, we were waiting for you guys. In the first call, you're saying, yeah, okay, let's do a bilateral.
Well, I mean, yeah. So I think he is sort of going to have to figure out his best approach and how he's going to approach this. I think he is, we talk often about how Canada is in a tough spot because we have to be both firm with the United States, but really we know we are dependent, our economy is dependent in so many ways on them. And obviously, if you are the president, a new incoming president of Mexico, and a president who has been elected as somebody who is supposed to turn the page on what is seen largely as a bit of a failed promise of the last administration, or the last two administrations, really, in terms of moving the Mexican economy forward, then you've got to be pretty careful as well about how you're approaching the president of the United States, and you want to try and, where you can, not make an enemy right off the bat. So I think everyone's sort of feeling their way through it. I think at the end of the day, I always go back to, this is not Canada's fault. this is not Mexico's fault. We did not ask for an active to reopen. We did not. We have not been intransigent in our negotiating style. Neither has Mexico. This is squarely at the feet of the President Trump, squarely at the feet of his administration, and their nonsensical, in my opinion, approach to all of this. And so people can be forgiven, especially newly elected leaders, for trying to figure their way through the maze as they go.
Well, we've got one leader that we're trying to negotiate with where his position can change quickly. Let's hope that we don't have another one. Colin, thanks for the time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right.